Hi, thank you all for coming out on this this really slushy, kind of gross Michigan evening. So it's a good night for staying in and having some poetry anyway. I should say on behalf of our co-sponsor, Michael Rodriguez, here at the MSU Library, this is part of the Michigan Writers Series. The event will be recorded and will be available to you all through the library catalog, which is a great resource if you haven't checked it out. There's a long list of writers whose work is available digitally that way. Thanks especially to Brian Gilmore for being willing to share his work with us. And co-sponsors Michael Rodriguez from the library, Lori Hollinger and Anita Skeen from the RCAH Center for Poetry, and Tyler Zamora, our new CW intern, for publicizing this event. I should add, too, I think Brian has books for sale, potentially, after the reading, and is certainly willing to sign and engage us all in conversation. Brian Gilmore is a poet, writer, public interest attorney, and columnist with the Progressive Media Project, the author of three collections of poems. Most recently, We Didn't Know Any Gangsters. Brian has had fellowships from Kali Kanem, Kimbilio, and the D.C. Commission on Arts and the Humanities. He is also a two-time winner of the Maryland State Art Council's Individual Artist Award. He divides his time between Michigan and Washington, D.C., where he teaches, here at MSU in the law school, where he lectures and writes on contemporary issues relating to housing and economic inequality. I've had the pleasure of spending time with Brian's poems this week, along with students from my advanced poetry class. There are many important lessons to be gleaned from his writing, among them his seamless ability to integrate personal and cultural histories, to bring issues of social justice into the realm of poetry in a way that is both immediate and intimate, rather concrete rather than abstract. His book, We Didn't Know Any Gangsters, is a coming-of-age narrative of sorts, infused with references to music, to literature, to pop culture and film. Richly textured, his poems are, in a word, smart, without ever becoming esoteric. In Philadelphia, I think my class's favorite poem, he tells us something about what it means to be a poet. Pens must move like scalpels, sliced through layers of lament, challenge, headlines, handed down through history. Please welcome me in joining, please join me in welcoming Brian Gilmore. Thanks.
Man, I know I don't recognize that guy. Thank you very much for the introduction. And definitely thank you to Michael, who I've gotten to know since I got to Michigan, and for everybody for coming out. And I'm going to read, starting out from We Didn't Know Any Gangsters, which was lucky enough to be a NAACP Image Award nominee and a Hurst and Wright nominee, on Cherry Castle. The first poem is Billy Bathgate, and it's inspired by the novel and movie by E.L. Doctorow, and this is for Chico. All I've got is this picture. It could have been Van Der Zee, Gordon Parks, Augie Ogburn, fresh from a Chancellor Williams shoot. We were capable boys, innocent, up some small mountain in summertime from that swamp of a city. We couldn't juggle balls, didn't know any gangsters. All we had was ice cold Michelob and red juicy melon, holy like water. We didn't know about rattlesnakes that I've now been told are all over that mountain. All I've got is this picture. I could call up the crew, though some of them are gone away now like wisps of smoke. Others are here, just floating on skyline like kite without string. We were capable boys, looking into the future as if we would live like Frederick Douglass or C.L.R. James. Did I mention the Michelob? Red, juicy melon, holy like water. Man, how about those rattlesnakes all around us now that we know they are there? All I've got is this picture. Unbreakable smiles, lean frames, polo shirts gripping young boys soon to be walking tightropes without poles. It's there, all of it. Ice cold Michelob, melon, holy like water, rattlesnakes. We couldn't juggle balls, didn't know any gangsters. We were capable boys. All I've got is this picture. Nosferatu. Last year, I took my daughter to see this film down in Grand Ledge, the original Nosferatu. So this poem is sort of inspired by that. People that like to stay out all night. The kid in the colorful long sleeve silk shirt. The 70s. Summer heat, making love to streets, worshiping asphalt. Stay out later and later, vampire, throwing rocks at street lights, alley lights, just needed to be night. For love of streets, just adore the streets and malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. A mother hears a street light explode. She knows her boy was wearing colorful silk shirt when he left. It's summer. People wearing long sleeve silk shirts in summer don't think rationally. Remember the music, the crazy ridiculous that could have done us like the dinosaurs. John Travolta doing the foxtrot, looking like he's dropped acid. Bell bottoms, stack heels, afros sprayed with something toxic. But really, it isn't the shirts, it's malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. She calls out her son's name, he's gone, like Kaiser Soze losing his limp. Really, he's Bela Lugosi and has become a bat, flown and jumped in someone's car, ready to worship streets, asphalt. He looks insane, short shorts, long tube socks up to his knees, and his shirt, long sleeve silkness, goes nowhere without it. His music, disco inferno, boogie nights, he laughs when it is played. Another streetlight will be gone soon, and later, when the city cools off like hot apple pie, when the men drop their rods in the water on the river and pop open ice-cold bottles of Miller High Life, the kid in the colorful long-sleeve silk shirt will stop by someone's house. They will pop bottles, too, and offer a toast to malt liquor, that wonderful elixir. A soldier story. This is for my father, who was a Korean War era person. He served in, when he was in high school, he said, he was like in the 11th grade, and he said, why am I waiting around to be drafted? So he just joined up and got his high school diploma in the Army. And a lot of people died in the Korean War. That's what people don't realize. It's one of the lesser publicized. It wasn't like it was in Vietnam, but there was a lot of people who died in there. And he remembers scoring really high on the entrance exam, and because of that, he didn't get shifted to combat. He got shifted to desk duty, and it made all the difference in the world. But the name of this poem is called A Soldier Story, and it's sort of about that. And it's in my father's voice. I will not die in Korea. My children will be born. Thousands of colored men dead like ants who have crawled too far for crumbs. Harry Truman giving hell. Executive Order 9981. This is what could have been. What wasn't shall never worry. I meet the man on his grisly turf. Never meet the rising sun. So many colored men dying like middle passengers dragged here by ship. NAACP loud like locusts. Coast Guardsman Haley scratches the word. Charles Rangel, Harlem hero, hell-given Harry wants to rule the world. I come down to the city of government, learn to type, get a good government job, GS-1 or 2, something to talk over with gin and lime. I meet a graduate of Paul Dunbar High, pretty lady who spins some tales, writes like the queen, doesn't fret about how it be. She walks behind Charles Drew, good God of blood, Jesse Fawcett, well-mannered with word. Her shorthand is a poem, civil service exam, freedom train, days full of rooms and men. She dances dark streets where she is told to stay, her mother out pounding the pave, buying bread, bringing the South up north for respect. Thousands write letters, send dollars for more. No more hot sun, cow milk days. Fields of rice, corn cake break. World Bank like crop share crooks, trapped in bricks, but give glory to God. I didn't die in Korea. I was lucky. My children born. I was courteous to the pretty Dunbar woman. I came to the city, got a good government job, fell in love with shorthand, talked about it humbly over gin and lime. But most of all, I learned how to type. And this is for my mother, make it plain. And she always told me this story about my father got a job, and it was like with the Defense Department in DC. Anybody from DC is somehow connected to the federal government or the city government. It's a government town. So he got a job, and it required a higher clearance. And it made them look into his, not only his past, but his father's past and his mother's past. So this is called Make It Plain, and this is about where, this is just me like sort of ad-libbing about my mother. My mother also was called in about this job. Make It Plain. And the epigram is from Edward R. Murrow. Good night. Good night. And good luck. My mother laughing at government men. My father has taken a new job. With folders and documents, they are telling my mother she married Karl Marx or Engels. This is the source of her chuckling. My father, Vladimir Lenin. My father, author of the Communist Manifesto. My mother must have typed it, disseminated copies to workers of the world. Today, she would have emailed it as an attachment. But this is 1955, comrade, and my father's whole family is trying to laugh about it too. They are Paul Robeson, Du Bois, Langston Hughes, and Dashiell Hammett insisting upon handcuffs rather than a microphone. Is your father Karl Marx? They ask all of them. How do you spell proletariat? What brand of cigarettes did Lenin smoke? You mean he smoked? I hear he quit cold turkey before he died. And Karl Marx, well, comrade, didn't he play for the Brooklyn Dodgers or something? This is not funny. Stop laughing. We all know about your father, a union man, Baltimore, Maryland, tried to organize a few things, get people to band together in the workplace like bees in a hive. He reads the Daily People's World. Your father's a bowler, right? He formed a team, and some of you were members, and at the bowling alleys, you didn't keep score. You just said, nice shot, comrade. My father's sisters and brothers no longer laugh. Two of my aunts almost lost their jobs because they could bowl. My father got interrogated for days because he knew how to pick up a spare. And my uncle, a clever man on the lanes, spent his 2-year stint in the army in a Kansas mess hall being spied upon like he was KGB. They gave my father the documents, the records, the job. He died with those secrets. My father always liked to bowl, kicked his leg out like Earl Anthony on ABC's Wide World of Sports, Saturday afternoons. My mother liked to bowl. She had a purple ball and ate the cheap French fries with all that magnificent Heinz ketchup dripping slow. She couldn't stop chuckling at the government men that day. Lenin, unions, October revolutions. And Karl Marx, my mother says, I am sure he never played baseball. The book is split up into, I would say, two parts. The part where it's more of where I was a sort of rowdy young kid trying to figure out my way, and then the second part where I left Washington and came back transformed. No, it wasn't like that. This is called 2001 Space Odyssey, and it's about me. I had gone to Howard University, which is the preeminent HBCU in the whole of the United States. And I didn't like it at all, so I was like all of a sudden just the family pariah. So this is called 2001, A Space Odyssey. And this is me talking to my parents. I want to go away to college, I tell my parents. A small, predominantly white college in the mountains of Western Maryland. Their faces a double Mona Lisa. A man is changing a flat tire in the middle of a busy intersection. I have walked up and told him, step aside. Let me get that for you. A dog with rabies is at my front door, barking wildly. I invite him in the house, offer him food. A few years back, my parents enrolled me in Howard University and finally began to sleep well at night. Like newborns, they hog call until one day I tell them, I hate the place like fire hates water, like red wine hates white carpet. Their rage that day is long, like the last note on Louis' West End Blues. I have just thrown a brick through a church window. The list is long. Father, uncle, doctor, dentist, lawyer down the street, teachers at the schools, all of the others who climbed over walls full of nails and tacks, who always threw back some rope. Then silence, endless like railways or interstates. They become the computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey, acting a damn fool. As I ask, open the pod doors, Hal. Hello, Hal, do you read me? They need not speak. They've been chased by dogs, almost run over by cars. They will sleep well at night in the coming days. I will scour the streets for churches with busted windows and offer to clean up the glass. Jaws, this is me, my excursion into this school that I went to, Jaws. As we cruise through the campus, there isn't a black face in sight. I am a slug after a rainstorm, salt has been poured. My father reaches the administration building, urges me to go pay the bill so he and my mother can go home. It is all so quick. In the building, I look up in front of the payment line, finally see a black person, a young girl who looks petrified. We are both on the raggedy boat with that stupid shark hunter who thinks he knows it all. The eerie music has started. It is getting louder. Round midnight. My mother and father have been gone for hours. It has sunk in like hands into potting soil. I am all alone. I imagine my parents back in the city laughing loud, asking themselves, why did he do this? How could he have traded in a jazz club for an 8-track of live bluegrass music? Purple Rain. This is for my roommate, favorite roommate of all time, wherever he is, George. My roommate wants to be Marilyn Perkins or Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom or Jacques Cousteau, the French deep sea diver who was cooler than Ron O'Neill dealing cocaine in Superfly. My roommate and I both want to live and die at the same time. We share this worldview as if we were born on the same day in Washington, D.C., uptown, raised on cherry smash soda pop, Bonton cheese, popcorn, bologna sandwiches, sweet potato pie, and AM radio emceed by Bobby Bennett. My roommate is white from Annapolis. My mother grew up with Dinah Washington singing, "You Go to My Head," right through her kitchen window while her mother stacked homemade buttermilk biscuits next to green beans and bacon. One night, my roommate and I were coming home from the Prince Purple Rain concert on a dark mountain road. A car began coming at us, going at least 100 miles per hour. These were the days where he and I would invite their entire student body to our dorm room and try to consume all of the rum ever distilled on the island of Puerto Rico. We both grabbed the wheel of his car that night, blew the horn until we were back in our room at the dorm laughing and talking to each other in the dark of our beds, until stench from the morning paper mill forced our eyes to close. This is what we did every night of the week. This is when I found out why he wanted to chase zebras across remote regions of Earth, or study the feeding habits of crocodiles and be paid for it. I never ever tell him what I want to do. I have no idea. Most days I just listen to Prince sing about 1999, Judgment Day, and read Rolling Stone magazine articles about how the government is killing people in Central America. Our room is full of Iron City beer, B-52 songs, Ron Rico rum, and mixed up young white kids who all want to die. They remind us each night when we talk in the dark that we are still out on the road, gripping that wheel like rope hanging from a cliff and laughing, looking down at the world like it's a woman we just met, and know we want to love. I'm gonna switch up here a little bit, and then I'll come back to the book. But I'm gonna read a couple poems about living in Michigan. I've been out here for like almost about 6 years now. There's a lot of interesting things I've experienced out here. I get around a lot because of my work, but I'll read maybe like two poems here. And this is called Detroit Sketch. And I don't know if any of you all know the poet M.L. Liebler. Plenty of people know him. Me and I'm a very good friends. We were very good friends before I even moved out here. But this is called Detroit Sketch number one for ML. And it was like one night I went down to see him and we just hung out in Detroit and we just talked. And then this poem sort of came out. Looking closely, I now see Chevys, Fords, Chryslers lining these streets like paupers standing in soup lines. Years ago, everyone really did still believe in this. They bought the cars. They embraced history. They sacrificed. They were devoted followers, not a cult, but invested. So they thought, learning love is not always reciprocal, and Adam Smith is not around to explain anything. There are no invisible hands seen around here anymore. That is, except for hands that once pulled levers. In Detroit, my Korean import does not get keyed. This is the dead folklore. David Halberstam, writer, prophetic. As I look again at these Chevys, Fords, Chryslers, lining these streets like paupers, standing in soup lines, I finally make sense of this love gone bad. We are the 21st century, the epoch of Wi-Fi. Assembly lines are now full of phones, pads, robots. There are no invisible hands seen around here anymore. That is, except for hands that once pulled levers. And this is a poem that came out of a bat got into my house one night, if you can believe that. I was like, this is a real Michigan experience. And it just made me think about a lot of other things that are quite intriguing about being here. But this is called Guns, Bats, and Books. And the quote epigram is from the Michigan Constitution. Every person has a right to bear arms for the defense of himself and the state. There was a bat in my house. Everyone thinks this is normal. When I call places that eradicate bats from houses, they say they really don't do that. They tell me, open up the doors, windows, wait for it to fly out. It makes no sense. Like all of the guns people have here, more guns than toothbrushes and combs and bottles of cheap cologne that couldn't get Rudy Valentino a date. Guns loved more than jelly beans at Easter. One guy rolled up in the public library, rifle strapped to his back, and was turned away. Broke his heart. He might as well have been some black person in Georgia in 1930 trying to rent a room for the night. He sued and won. You got a right to carry rifles in the public library now, but you can't eat food in there. They should open a gun shop downstairs where they sell used books. They should close the computer room and teach gun safety. They should sell ammo and not use books to raise money for library upkeep. They should arrest anyone carrying books concealed under their coats. They should make the librarians teach us how to lock and load. They should just turn the whole thing into a 24-hour gun range. There is a bat in my house, and I do not know how to get it out. It flew around, landed on some ledge, and it's now just lying there like Count Dracula, waiting for the sun to set. I can't take any chances. I plan to buy a gun. When the bat flies in my house again, I plan to shoot it down right away. If you don't act fast, I've been told, they will think they can stay forever. I read that in some book. All right, I'll read one more of these Michigan pieces. Went to a city called Inkster, so for one of my students, we had to go down for work that I do at the law college. And this is called Inkster Blues. I don't know if anybody's been to Inkster. But when I left there, I said, this is definitely the blues. Way down there in Inkster, weeds growing out of cement. I say, way down there in Inkster, weeds growing out of cement. The people down there in Inkster want to know where all the money they had done went. Down the way in Inkster, there is just one auto plant making cars. I say, down the way in Inkster, there is just one auto plant making cars. A lot of churches and used car shops, too many overcrowded bars. We rode 96 to Inkster trying to save a woman's home. I say, we rode 96 to Inkster trying to save a woman's home. The courthouse was so crowded, I thought of the fall of Rome. We rode through the streets of Inkster in search of something to do. I say, we rode through the streets of Inkster in search of something to do. Stopped off in some coney joint and spilled hot chili on my shoe. Went to City Hall in Inkster, and there was no one there in charge. I say, went to City Hall in Inkster, there was no one there in charge. Young man on the street tell me here people used to live large. So I took my leave of Inkster. I seen enough to write this song. I say, so I took my leave of Inkster, seen enough to write this song. Like all them other Michigan cities, somebody done her wrong. So the other poetry I've been writing about D.C. So I will read two poems that are inspired by D.C. And one is from the spoken word period from the 90s. I don't know if anybody remembers that. The spoken word period in the 90s in D.C. and all over the United States. Really, it was a big deal. It really rejuvenated, gave a lot of energy back into poetry. And a lot of those people now are like big-time, well-known poets, like Patricia Smith, who was like a three-time slam champ, and Jeff McDaniels, and these like people I knew, things like that, but they were like, they came up on the spoken word scene, and now they're like, they're just poets putting out books and things now. But this one is spoken word number 43, and I'm just writing a series of spoken, I was reading poetry back then, but I never did the slam thing too much. I used to like going to the slam, because it was a lot of fun. But this is called spoken word number 43. Annapolis, Maryland, this is one of my first experiences with the whole, what was going on back then. Cigarette smoke is in the air, thick like Appalachian fog. Espresso chugging like this is some cafe in Rome. Where are you, Enzo? Annapolis, the Navy town. Like, ain't that Ernest Borgnine over there smoking a Lucky Strike? Tim Conway writing haiku, cackling in Japanese. Fake beatniks have read too much Burroughs, is all I see. Some got dreads dusted with dandruff and are afraid of water. No, no, they don't have rabies. They think they were in the siege of Grenada or lost their legs in Beirut. Life is nothing and nobody really is alive. They've got all the money but want to eat daily from trash cans. Jack Kerouac, you loser. I'm gagging on camel smoke and three-hour poems because of your confusion. There isn't a person in here who wants to live except me and some homeless dude who will leave cold cheeseburgers in my car. He is allergic to the smoke worse than me. We grin and bear it because we are searching for Howell. But Howell was written under heavy duress. This is a Civil War reenactment, but Walt Whitman left the place laughing. In a moment, I expect to hear some Monk or Fats Navarro. That is when I head for the door. We stagger from the haze. The 50s was way too scary for almost anyone. Assimilators beware, but we aren't assimilating. My name is Don L. Lee, and I am allergic to cigarette smoke. My name is Askia Ture. I like cheeseburgers. My name is Sonia Sanchez, and I don't drink espresso. My name is Allen Ginsberg, and I told you, don't go in there. Raise it in the sun. This is if you go up in DC, every few years, 4 or 8 years, we get a new neighbor, and it's the President of the United States. That's how it was when I was a kid. So, I mean, I've been writing about how does Obama, what does he be thinking about when he's in the White House? So this is called Raising in the Sun, one of a series of these. I wasn't born in America. I was born in Hawaii. I am not really black. I didn't grow up around black people. I can't make sweet potato pie. I can't fry chicken. I can play basketball, but I don't have a crossover. I never read Jet or Ebony growing up. I never saw Soul Train or Sanford and Son either. Good Times is a disco song by Chic, but I never knew who Chic was either. Rumor is I dropped acid. Listen to the Eagles, mostly Hotel California. And Kiss painted my face white with stars. I rode a skateboard. I read Stephen King, not James Baldwin or Richard Wright. Martha's Vineyard, is that George Washington's old lady? The Underground Railroad was really underground. Dred Scott's a Rasta. Shut the hell up. My father left me. Went back home like he was Marcus Garvey or Du Bois or Carl Hansberry going to Mexico. He was from Chicago. He believed in this. He didn't want to eat his pulled pork on the South Side only. They hit his daughter with a brick. Broke his heart. Now we gotta hear about it a few hundred times a year. Walter Younger. Walter Younger. Walter Younger. God damn. I wasn't born in America. But I live there now. People there hate me because I am black. Because I don't have a crossover and can't fry chicken. But mostly because I never come out anymore. I stay home, read essays by James Baldwin, fiction by Richard Wright, watch Raisin in the Sun until my hair turns black. I finished with a trilogy in the poem, in the book, for my children, my three daughters. And I think it's appropriate because one of the poems is inspired by the late, great Abe Vigoda, just died, I think, yesterday or 2 days ago. Abe Vigoda, love that guy. But this is called The Godfather, and I have three daughters. So I wrote a poem called The Godfather. And of course, you got three daughters. The other ones want a poem. So it's three of them, Godfather 1, 2, and 3. So this is The Godfather for Adanya. At 18 months. Adanya, who is now 16. It's that scene from The Godfather, which I've watched over and over. The Don has passed, chasing his grandson through the vegetable garden. The traitor has been revealed at the funeral. Sad-eyed Abe Vigoda asked lawyer Tom Hayden to get him out for old time's sakes, because it was just business. Can't do it, Sally, is all that said. Though Abe is almost saved because of his face, that wonderfully precious, charitable face which could make a father cry. Because like Tom, I too am a lawyer, and this is what I see each night in my 18-year-old daughter's eyes. Abe Vigoda, sad-eyed, looking to be saved from the Sandman. Now she is working on me and giving it her best shot with those despondent but hopeful Abe Vigoda eyes. My daughter has to sleep in her crib for trying to cut a secret deal with one of the other five New York families. She wants me to get her out for old time's sake. She knows I am not strong and loyal like lawyer Tom Hayden. I look into her eyes and replay that scene again. I see Abe being led away to sleep with the fishes. Francis Ford Coppola is lucky he didn't cast my 18-month-old for his film. Who would have believed that an infant black girl would one day run the mob? The Godfather 2 for Lyrit at 2. Marlon Brando is dead. My daughter will only dream of him. She and I shall go to the waterfront and see that he does not sleep with the fishes. But he's gone nonetheless, like those kids from New Jersey Drive, joyriding like cicadas on the wrong windshield. Marlon Brando is dead. My daughter will never know him. Only Don Corleone can speak to her now, a silly man who talks as if he is trying to sound like Miles Davis. She and I shall watch his movie over and over, just as I did in college, law school, and any time I wanted to feel as if I were loved. Marlon Brando is dead. Michael did not come to save him. He and Enzo got lost on the way to the hospital, and the Don is gone. My daughter will never meet him or have a chance to love a Sicilian. Here is a man who loves his daughter, I could have told her. Here is a man who would save the world. Marlon Brando is alive. He was saved by us all. Years from now, I will invite him to my daughter's wedding so he can watch us dance before the world. He will have the greatest time eating our food, listening to our music. People will come visit me in the parlor, and he will watch them ask me for favors. I will point to him and tell them that there is the man they need to speak to, a man who will make you offers you cannot refuse, a man who will come to see you late one evening and ask you if you love your children. The Godfather 3 for Pannonica at 6. My father only owned 2 albums by Monk, Crisscross, and the one where Monk is sitting on a little red wagon. Years later, I sat next to a Jewish guy in law school. We talked Monk before and after class, Ellington and Charlie Parker, but mostly Monk on the little red wagon. It is as if we were alive then, as if we knew how it felt to be born in the 50s. On the CD issue of Monk's Cross, there is a song named after a moth. Monk would later say it was a butterfly. But who's arguing? It is still like hot sauce on your eggs or shrimp mixed with grits in the morning. Somehow, this moth came flying into a hospital one Easter morning. It was tiny and acted as if the wind would blow it to dust. But the moth could fly better than the best Boeings in bluest sky of morning. Nurses wanted to give the moth a name, but names can wait. Names are for Ellis Island, 1914, and she is not a horse who has been through desert. She is not the High Plains Drifter. She is not a character in a Ralph Ellison novel. She is not a bar in the movie Shaft. She sits on a red wagon. She waits on Chick Corea. She is in love with Charlie Parker. She is adored by Sonny Rollins. She is a movie that had to be made. She is not rebellious. She does not smoke cigarettes. She flies through her days better than Boeings in bluest sky of morning. Thank you very much. So if anybody had a question, I don't know.
Yeah, if you have any questions, but if you have questions, go ahead. The mics are there for a reason, because these things are being recorded, but you don't have to.
Right.
Good evening.
What's up?
Thank you for your beautiful poems. Since the last 3 are in my head right now, I'd like to ask you about, and I know your beautiful daughters, what qualities did you like key into, and how did you find those references in relation to your daughter as you thought about those poems?
Well, definitely for the third one, it was each of them sort of was tried to like make the poem sort of like part of their, what they are like as a person and things like that. But it's especially relevant to the last one because the poem is about she was a preemie. She was a little bit early. So she had to stay in the hospital for a while and she didn't get a name. They just had it written on their baby Gilmore on her thing. And that's what a lot of the references in the poem is about that she didn't have a name and that she was, you know, we were just hoping she would be all right. That's what the poem is really about. And the other two are, you know, also very similar like that. The first one is the first child that told, I can remember walking in and she was screaming like she was out of her mind, right? You know how that is with babies. And I just looked at her face and that's all I thought about was that those sagging eyes, Abe Vigoda. She was like looking at me like, it was just like where they were leading him away, like, oh man, they're gonna kill Abe Vigoda. I mean, that's all I thought about. And it's the same thing with the second one. She just reminded me a lot of Brando and, you know, very charismatic and things like that. So when Brando died and she had asked me about who he was and things like that, and I told her who he was and ended up writing a poem about it. So that ended up being like the inspiration for him because he was a very eccentric, charismatic type person. She's not eccentric, but she's very charismatic. So the poem sort of tried to take on those characters from the Godfather, the whole series. It's good it's not a Godfather 4, because I don't have 4 kids. Just have 3. Anybody else?
Hi. So I love all your references to pop culture, and as a writer, I find that one of the many frustrating things for me is putting references into my work and not making it sound so forced, but you do it so seamlessly. So are there any tips or how do you go about doing that? Is it more like a methodical process or is it just pieces from your life that you just place in there or how do you go about that?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it's a lot of writers. I would say you probably just read a lot of writers who do it in different ways. I know some people set out to work it in there. Like Purple Rain, one of the poems I read. I mean, we went to the concert, so that was easy. That's an easy way of doing it. But it's a writer, Kamal Braithwaite, who's a West Indian writer, and he seems to write in this style where he sort of lets the poem take the thought to the next level and then get back to the central theme of the poem. And sometimes it's kind of difficult. It's almost like a music thing. Where they used to say to Charlie Parker, the great saxophone player, he would solo, and they would tell the other musicians, it's like, don't try to follow him, you know what I mean? They're like, look, let him go out there where he's going. He's going to come back. Don't try to, if you follow him, you're going to get lost. And it's kind of like, how I look at it. You sort of, when you go through your drafts and your edits, you sort of have to like, think how far to go out there because you don't want to lose what you're trying to say ultimately. But some of it works because some of it helps push the poem along. And I know Kamal Braithwaite is one of the poets I know, and there's a lot of other poets who do it. It's okay to take it for a little while, maybe not too long. I mean, it's definitely something you got to think about, how far you want it to go, because you do not want to lose what you ultimately wanted to say in the poem by going out on a tangent. You don't want to lose that. But that's probably the best I can say. But I would say just read a lot of people, I would say, and watch what they do because people that have really been at it for a while do it really well. And that's what I try to do. I try to read definitely people who I wouldn't write like. I mean, I try to put myself in an uncomfortable space. And then that way I can pull some things from writers who I might not necessarily feel an affinity with, but I feel like I can get something from them.
I want to speak to your question for a minute because I've read Gregory Barlow's book Digest.
Right.
The Pulitzer Prize last year. He's a
amazing at his ability to do that and mix it with classical references.
Right. I think he's another example of somebody who's able to, like, don't let it go too far. He stays with his thing, but he works it in.
He's amazing. He's the balance is wonderful. And if you don't know his work or don't know that book, I would suggest that you read that. I find it a difficult book, but boy, it's worth it. And he can do it better than anybody I think I know. Right.
Hi. So we've read some of your work in our advanced poetry class, and I was just wondering about your choices on capitalization or lack thereof. And a lot of it, just if maybe you could give a brief explanation about that, or
no capitalization.
Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, I came up as a poet. I guess I got started in the '80s. I mean, I was heavily influenced by the Black arts poets, and their whole thing was like break. Destroy the English language, the alphabet. They just wanted to misspell words deliberately, you know, and small type was just it. And that's just something that's just stayed. I think I have a few poems now that are capital. I don't know. It doesn't matter that much to me anymore, but when I first started out, I wanted to be like them. So all the poets who were doing that, like Don L. Lee, Sonia Sanchez, Askia Toure, everybody wrote in small. I mean, they just wanted to, like, we're going to take the English language, we're going to recreate it. Not only are we going to write, have our own style of poetry, but we're going to recreate the language itself. And the words will deliberately misspell words, that kind of thing. They started taking the G's off of the ing words and things like that. They would spell again without the A, A-G-I-N. I mean, that was the kind of thing they were doing. But my thing was, I liked the way it looked and things like that. But that was just... I just picked that up from them. That's all it really was. And it's a lot of people that still do it. Definitely wasn't an E. E. Cummings thing. I can't take credit for that. I like E. E. Cummings' work, but that's not the person who I was trying to chase. So.
That's it. I have one more, if that's okay. I mean, you're a writer, you wear many hats, right?
Right. It's kind of, for me, it always was. Oh, she asked. Well, the question was, how did the different writing fields and the different things I do talk to me and talk to each other, I guess. Yeah. And that's a great question, because for me, it's always has worked out. Like, it always seemed like it was just one thing, I mean, from the start, I guess, because I became a poet, and I almost immediately went to law school, because the poetry I was writing when I first started out was social justice, straight, anti-Reagan, you know, anti-poverty. South Africa was the big thing. We were like, you know, it was all one thing. And it has just worked out as to be one thing, and it has took me a little while to accept myself as that. And that became better once I got to know, like, people who, I got to know the history of poetry, all these great poets, and they weren't like walking around, like, selling poetry, feeding their family with it. I was like, they were like, they had like jobs and stuff like that. William Carlos Williams was a medical doctor. I mean, it's just down the line. So I just, you know, but for the writing, it was always like one thing for me. I feel like the poetry always informs the law for me, because I even use it in my classes and things. It's just so much there, so much humanity there for the type of law that I do. And then the other way, I think the law, like, informs the poetry. To me, it just sort of, they just sort of feed off each other at this point. And I've contemplated even dropping one of them at times, but I don't really know how to get out now, right? I really don't know how to do it any other way. I mean, who knows what happens. But there's a lot of great, the one of the best, most important poetry books ever is Edgar Lee Masters. And people don't know, he was Clarence Darrow's law partner. And he wrote like one of the most important poetry books in the history of poetry, in American poetry. just knocked you out. Martina Spada is a former legal aid lawyer. It's just things like that. Once you find these things out, you realize that the poets are, you know, they are always chasing something about, you know, humanity and things like that. And I think that's what it's about. But they feed off each other. They, you know, writing law stuff can like destroy your destroy your verse style, you know. And then the other way too, your poetry can bleed into your lawyer writing. So you do have to like make sure you keep that separation in your head. I don't know how you do that. I mean, usually with just try to write every day, I would say. I try to write every day, even if it's just like toying with metaphors and things like that on my notepad. So that's a great question. That's it. No questions.
Hi, I'm in Dr. Silverglide's advanced poetry class as well, where we've looked at your work. And so I'm interested in, you spoke about social justice and how that's a central theme in your poetry, and you spoke about the spoken word movement as well. And I guess my question, kind of from that perspective, is how do you think, what do you think the best way is to re-engage, like, the youth culture with poetry? Because personally, I've been involved with spoken word for a long time, and I think it has a lot of potential to be that activist kind of platformer to help with literacy. And I think, you know, I'm actually probably going to show some of your work at a workshop I'm doing for middle schoolers. So I'm just kind of interested in your thoughts on that.
Right, that's a great question. I mean, I know when I came up, when I taught poetry, I still, now and then I still do workshops, but I taught for 2 years in this this thing called the Writers' Corps, DC Writers' Corps, and we just rent out into the community and we started writing workshops at random locations, libraries, high schools, mental health facilities. I had one, it's a poem in a book, the poem you reference is Philadelphia. We started a prisoners writing workshop, me and DJ Renegade, Daryl Stover, and now super famous Ta-Nehisi Coates. Every time I talk to Ta-Nehisi now, I'm like, laugh. It's like, man, you like have blown out the sky. You know what I mean? We used to be teaching in Lorton Performatory Prison outside DC together. So, I mean, I think you just have to take the poetry to, I mean, I think what you said is already you're doing part of it right there. I mean, taking it to the middle school, taking it to them. Because, I mean, the children these days are very receptive to that. When I came up, it was a lot different. It wasn't pushed at you like that. It was all page. It wasn't, as they say, stage, page and stage. It wasn't like that. It was just all the written word. But now, the kids now, they are definitely receptive to getting it in a lot of different forms. And that has been helped by spoken word and, of course, by hip-hop music, which is an easy entry point. When we taught, we always use hip-hop music to show them that they already are being exposed to poetry at a high level by people who they already love and emulate. So that's a great question. Oh, another question.
How you doing?
What's up?
You write and speak so lovingly about Washington, D.C., growing up there and everything. Now, in your writings, do you write what's going on now in D.C. with the regentrification and D.C. not being the D.C. maybe that you grew up in?
The end of Chocolate City. Right. In fact, the poems I'm writing are sort of are about like watching D.C. change and how it's so much different now than it was when I came up. It was just different. It was, but it's, in a way, it's still the same. It's all these transients who come because Obama is about to leave town. as everybody knows. So then the Chicago crew is going to be gone. But then whoever wins, that their crew is going to hit town, hit the city, and they're going to be a presence in the city. Like when Bill Clinton got in, it was all these Arkansas folks who relocated, who got jobs in the government and things like that. So, but it is changing. They say that, historically, D.C. was like 30% African-American, but then when I came through, it was like 70, maybe 80. It's like, it was a whole rhyme about that, the blood to blood, a player to ladies. The last percentage count was 80, because they said that it was 80% African-American, but I think it was about 70%. But it is changing, and it is a more quite expensive to live there now, which is, that's probably the saddest thing, is that they're killing the possibility for community by pricing everybody out. And it just is what it is. It's, a lot of cities are going through that. But so if people that's written about it, it's a great book. It's a couple books already out. There'll be a few more coming out about the end of that whole era, but hopefully I'll finish my poems. So I'm getting around to it. Thanks a lot for that question.